At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Congressional budgets today and the bottom line of a no-fly zone. Remember toxic assets and mortgage-backed securities? They never really went away, you know. And another installment of Freakonomics Radio coming up from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, the 22nd day of March, 2011. Good to have you with us. Here's a news bulletin I read on the wires just before I came into the studio. It's Reuters quoting an anonymous senior American official as saying that the U.S. expects to see more Arab participation in the Libya effort over the next several days. That comes as the coalition enforcing the no-fly zone launched another 24 Tomahawk missiles today at $750,000 apiece. An Air Force F-15 had mechanical problems and crashed. The crew is safe, but the jet is a $40 million write-off. You start talking dollar amounts like that, and you get to $1 billion pretty fast. And that matters because $1 billion is about how much the Pentagon says it can spend out of straight cash flow without having to go to Congress for a supplemental budget. So Washington probably is expecting to see more Arab participation soon because Congress hasn't been much in the mood to spend money lately. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
For now, the Defense Department is drawing on existing accounts to cover the Libyan operation. But federal tax expert David Selig says the Pentagon
easily could end up spending $100 billion by the end of the summer if we're not careful.
Eventually, Congress will get the bill, and if lawmakers want to cut deficits, Robert Bixby of the budget watchdog Concord Coalition says it's time to take a stand.
Well, they should either raise revenue to pay for it, or they could cancel some other defense spending or some spending in the domestic accounts to offset the supplemental that they would need for Libya.
Bixby's worry is that Congress will treat the request the same way it dealt with Iraq and Afghanistan.
They may go back to the old emergency exemption, which is that anything that people label an emergency, they feel that they don't need to pay for. But the deficit itself is becoming an emergency, and so I think that we are going to have to start paying for things, even if they're things that we want to do.
There is another option, says Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Now Libya's surface-based air defense system has largely been suppressed. You can shift the mission over to manned aircraft from Britain, France, and other countries, and shift the costs as well.
So far, Congress has aimed its budget-cutting firepower on non-defense spending. The president's decision to join military action in Libya will force lawmakers to set their sights on the Pentagon as well. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We'll have more Libya and the latest from Japan as well coming up in just a little bit. But first, a blast from the past on this Tuesday. Mortgage-backed securities are back in the news. Toxic assets might be a more familiar phrase. The Treasury Department bought up almost $150 billion worth of those assets 3 years ago when the fate of the global economy seemed to be hanging in the very balance. This week, the Treasury Department announced it's going to start selling them off. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains what that might mean for markets and for mortgages.
When the market for mortgage-backed securities froze, banks couldn't sell home loans to investors, so they stopped making home loans. And investors, such as pension funds and mutual funds, feared their mortgage-backed securities would become worthless.
All hell was breaking loose. It was the height of the crisis. Every fire alarm was going off.
Karen Petru with Federal Financial Analytics says to keep financial markets from imploding, the Treasury started buying mortgage bonds, and it's been holding them until now.
You have to do something with them, or the government will own the mortgage market, and I don't think anybody wants that.
The Treasury will be selling the bonds off gradually. Bill Stone is chief investment officer with PNC Wealth Management. He says this is the government's latest move to unwind some of the actions it took during the financial crisis.
It's consistent with what the Treasury's been doing. You know, they've sold off their Citigroup stake. They sold part of their stake in GM.
Stone says this is also a signal the government thinks the housing market is solid enough to function on its own, which could be a stretch, says economist Michelle Meyer with Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
It was just that the timing, I think, threw us and the markets by surprise. We would have expected Treasury to wait until the housing market was on more solid footing.
Meyer says putting even a modest amount of mortgage-backed securities on the market could push mortgage rates higher and make banks even less inclined to lend than they are now. Ultimately, though, Meyer says, the Treasury Department is small potatoes. Its sales will be a dry run for the Federal Reserve, which is sitting on nearly $1 trillion worth of mortgage bonds. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The major indices were down today, but just a hair. I don't know, maybe traders are getting used to a constant state of crisis. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. To the extent that people in Libya even have electricity and the desire to watch the news instead of live it, they're probably getting their information from a couple of different places. Al Jazeera Television, CNN, and the state-owned broadcaster Jamahiriya TV in Libya. Government-controlled media is the norm across much of the Arab world. We've called Marwan Krady to talk about how it works in Libya and elsewhere in the region. He teaches media and politics at the University of Pennsylvania. Marwan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Same here.
Is Gaddafi using state-run media, his propaganda arm, effectively now, do you think? I mean, is that in his equation?
Well, you know, he redefines what effective means. It really depends on what we think about when we say effective. Gaddafi has a full-throttle propaganda machine going on. And to the extent that it's lies after lies after lies after lies, I guess some of it might stick, but I don't think Libyans are dupe.
Contrast this for me, would you, with what's been happening in Egypt, right? They had state-run media, they had the revolution. Now what do they have and how has it changed? And is that possibly, in the long term, what might happen in Libya?
Well, Egypt has a much richer media scene than Libya. It has a very large state bureaucracy and many channels, but also some private channels. And it has a history of production in theater and film and television. So it has a much bigger talent pool to draw on. The Libyan television channel is much more of a what we would think of as a totalitarian type of propaganda, as opposed to Egypt, kind of authoritarian, state-controlled, state-manipulated media.
And then what about how Westerners are seeing what's going on there? And I'm thinking mostly of Al Jazeera, which is distinctly not state-controlled.
Yes, Al Jazeera is not state-controlled, but Al Jazeera is undergoing a very interesting shift now in that its coverage of Libya is definitely on the side of the opposition to Gaddafi, but its coverage elsewhere in Bahrain, in Morocco, in Jordan, in Oman, in Yemen has been much more muted. So there's something going on having to do with the Gulf Cooperation Council countries deciding that they were going to stop the uprisings from entering into their own countries. Al Jazeera is sponsored and influenced to a large degree by the Emir of Qatar, who's a member of the Gulf Cooperation Council.
So look at Egypt for me once again and help me understand what a model for some kind of state broadcasting enterprise might be. Not necessarily state-controlled, but with the authority of the state and how they might be able to make that work.
First of all, the government that runs the state has to be credible. Once you have a credible government, then the media apparatus that the government sets up has a degree of credibility, of legitimacy, that will lead people to watch state television. Because the main problem with state television channels is that at the best of times, they get 2 or 3% of the audience in Jordan, in Syria, in Egypt. But we do already see some very important changes on state television, on state-owned newspapers. The tone has changed. The coverage has changed. Although it's very difficult to know because it's too early to have actual research, I am very confident that the ratings, the number of viewers has gone up.
Marwan Krady is a professor of communications at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. Marwan, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kyle.
Most of what's being said out there about the economic impact of the earthquake in Japan has been about the industrial effects. Factories that have been closed down and supply chains that have been interrupted. But the service economy in Japan has been walloped as well. Until about 10 days ago, tourism was a $300 billion a year industry there. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has more of our coverage of the economic effects of the disaster from Tokyo now, a city that in an average year draws millions of tourists.
Rickshaw drivers call out to visitors of Tokyo's Sensoji Temple. All the guidebooks say this is the place to visit if you've got just one day in Tokyo. But now, with the threat of radiation in the air, one day in Tokyo is one day too long for most tourists, says driver Haruyuki Asaka.
This is usually the time of year when business picks up because it's close to cherry blossom season. But our sales are about 10% of what we usually make.
Asaka manages a rickshaw tour company. He's usually in the office, dressed in a suit and tie, but today he's wearing a traditional rickshaw uniform, navy blue robe, tights, and form-fitting shoes. He's carrying the few tourists up and down the neighborhood's alleys.
The business is running in the red, and I'm a full-time employee. Our drivers aren't, so if I run the rickshaw myself, it'll help save the company money.
Last year, a record 9.5 million foreigners visited Japan. On a typical day, Sensoji Temple is teeming with them. But there isn't one foreign face among the Japanese worshippers today. Wait, there's a couple. I run through a courtyard to track them down. They're Miguel Moledo and Silvio Alonso, and they're from Spain. They're just as surprised to see me.
Maybe you're the only ones that we've seen since we've been here. But
it's just us three.
I think so, yeah.
The two were visiting friends in Osaka, a city about 350 miles south from the Fukushima nuclear power plant. They're a little worried about sticking around, but not for reasons you'd think.
I've been more worried for our families than for the actual problem, because they've been trying to get in contact with us, sending emails, like asking us to leave the country and come back home. And we've been trying to explain for a week that it's nothing happening in Osaka. So all this is happening in the north of Japan.
Down an alleyway is a souvenir shop run by Yuki Kinoshita. She sells kimonos, traditional sandals, and postcards. All her signs are in English. 90% of her customers are foreigners. She says her business has dropped off 98% since the earthquake hit.
I'm a single mother, and I'm supporting my father, too. So I'm doing whatever it takes to make money. We've just started selling our goods on the internet to foreigners who are too scared to come to Japan. We're also tailoring our souvenirs to what Japanese tourists might like.
Despite radiation fears, today's crowd at Sensoji Temple is an unusually big one. There may be no foreigners, but Kingo Yuzumi is one of many Japanese visitors.
I came here expecting to have the place to myself, but there's a lot of people here. This gives me hope.
Izumi came here to pray for his ancestors, something he does regularly. He suspects many are here to pray for those who've perished in last week's disaster. If there's a silver lining to all of this for Japan's tourism industry, he says, maybe it'll encourage more Japanese to start visiting, and maybe even contributing to, their local temples. In Tokyo, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The news from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant continues to be a mixture of good and bad. There is outside electrical power hooked up now, but temperatures inside at least one of the reactors are still too high. And the World Health Organization weighed in on food contamination today. Traces of radiation have been found in milk, vegetables, and seafood collected near the plant. The WHO says the problem is more serious than first thought and that it's not a localized issue. More problems are pretty much the last thing that Japan needs right now, but rising food prices may be on the way. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
On top of everything else, Japanese consumers have food issues. Hoarders have cleaned out grocery store shelves, replacement shipments are backed up at the ports, and rolling electrical blackouts threaten anything that needs refrigeration.
There is progress being made, but we think it'll take another couple of weeks before there's some kind of routine, if you will, back to the Japanese food markets.
That's Dan Bossi, president of Ag Resource Company, an agricultural consulting firm. Even during good times, Japan imports about 60% of its food. Bossi expects U.S. agriculture will get a boost as Japanese consumers worry about radioactivity in homegrown products. He says the Japanese government may reconsider rules imposed on U.S. beef in 2004 after an outbreak of mad cow disease.
The Japanese have demanded that cattle slaughtered and sent to them are at a much younger age than we consume here in the United States. Will they drop that age requirement as their demand for U.S. beef for meat becomes greater?
Others think Japan is not likely to end quotas and tariffs on U.S. imports. Bill Lapp is with the ag forecasting firm Advanced Economic Solutions.
I don't think we're going to see a significant shift away from current policies.
Lapp does expect to see increased demand for U.S. goods in the months ahead.
But I don't think it's a significant shift to a new and higher level of trade into Japan as a result of this.
Right now, Japanese consumers might welcome extra imports. Tight supplies are expected to make Japan's food more expensive. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, fatal fires, Freakonomics style.
Now with the less fire-prone cigarette, it should self-extinguish.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials nicked off 17 points today, about a 0.1%, ended at 12,018, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ peeled away 8 points, 0.3%, finished at 2683. The S&P 500 splashed away 4 points, a 0.3%, closed at 1293. Carnival Corporation was not in a partying mood today. The cruise line sank 4.3%. Higher fuel prices are cutting into profits, and its quarterly forecast didn't quite measure up to analyst expectations either. Walgreens paled 6.5%. The biggest U.S. drugstore chain says government cutbacks on prescription drug payments could hurt its profits. Netflix shares uploaded 4%. Credit Suisse upgraded its stock. The 10-year T-note was more or less in place, the price was, with a yield then at 3.33%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on new home sales for February. On March 23, 2001, after 15 years in orbit, Russia's Mir space station returned to Earth. It was brought down in a fiery blaze breaking up over the southern Pacific Ocean. And speaking of Earth's atmosphere, let's talk about the weather. It's World Meteorological Day. There's a theme, climate for you. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today, Vice President Biden announced a plan to make the United States the number one country in the world for college graduation rates. South Korea has a top spot at the moment. We, however, have a ways to go. The U.S. is in a four-way tie for ninth place. 42% of the college-age population here finishes school. Doesn't sound all that great, but commentator Ben Wildowski says the situation isn't really all that bleak.
You've probably heard how American kids are falling behind the rest of the world educationally, how the Chinese are eating our lunch, how we're facing a Sputnik moment. These anxieties flared up when the results of the Program for International Student Assessment came out recently. So how did U.S. students rank? An unimpressive 31st out of 65 countries in math, 23rd in science, and 17th in reading. Meantime, kids in Shanghai took the test for the first time ever and outscored everybody. Looks like America's golden age has ended, right? We've lost our edge. Actually, there never was an educational golden age in the U.S. A new Brookings Institution report shows that the United States ranked 11th out of 12 countries when the first international math tests were given in the 1960s. What's more, the recent scores show that the U.S. actually improved modestly. We're still only average for developed countries in science, a little below average in math, and middling in reading. But we're moving in the right direction. Most of the latest test score coverage focused on the sky-high Shanghai results. But those numbers don't say much about Chinese education overall. Shanghai is a talent magnet that's showered with government spending. It just doesn't represent the whole country. There's no doubt that the U.S. faces serious educational problems. We need to tackle them. But we shouldn't panic about international comparisons. Here's another example from the world of research universities. Since 2002, our share of global scientific research has declined more than any other country's. But American scientists have actually produced 46,000 more articles over the same period. We do have a smaller piece of the pie, but the pie has gotten much bigger. And that's good. We shouldn't fear that other countries' educational gains come at our expense. Knowledge crosses borders and benefits everyone. yes, we must improve, but we're all better off in a better educated world.
Ben Woldofsky is a senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation. His commentary was adapted from his article on the myths and realities of global education competition. It's in the new issue of Foreign Policy magazine. If you've got a comment, send it along. Marketplace.org is our website. Click on the link that says contact. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is, of course, about the hidden side of everything. Dubner, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Kai. Rizdahl. if you don't mind, yes. I've got a slightly personal question for you today.
All right.
I want to know what scares a guy like Kai Rizdahl, if anything. Like, what scares you? Like, do you think about scary ways of dying, for instance?
Oh, it used to be airplane crashes, but right. Not so much
there
anymore.
There you go. Now, let me ask you this then, Kai. When's the last time you worried about dying in a fire?
Never.
Exactly. Now,
yeah.
You can thank for that an event 100 years ago, a tragic event, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City.
Yeah, there was an HBO documentary aired last night. We had the producers on the show yesterday. Good conversation.
Right. So this fire killed 146 people, most mm-hmm. of them immigrant seamstresses, as you probably know. Now, here's the strange thing. The building itself was one of this new breed of fireproof buildings, which meant it was made of steel and brick that wouldn't burn and collapse. But all the stuff inside, they could burn, and they did. Here's Robert Solomon of the National Fire Protection Association. That's an industry group that writes fire safety codes.
The Triangle Shirtwaist fire was kind of that watershed moment when everybody said, enough. When you look at the building regulations at that time, many of them were really directed at preserving the building itself and the contents, but the people kind of not given a very high priority.
So that's what changed after the Triangle fire, right? It was people above building.
That's exactly right. You know, back in the day, it was mostly insurance companies who were driving the fire prevention agenda. They insured buildings more than people. So on this one day, in one fire 100 years ago, 146 people died. But if you look at the numbers today in New York City, fewer than half that many people, 62, were killed in fires in the entire city during all of last year.
So that's kind of an amazing statistic. But let me ask you this. Why do we hear more about falling crime rates than falling rates of death by fire?
That's my question exactly. No good answer for that other than we tend to take things for granted once they're given to us. But, you know, even with the massive murder drop in recent years, we're still at about the same murder rate as we were 50 years ago. Fire deaths, meanwhile, have fallen 77% over that same time. Probably the single biggest factor in that was the widespread use of automatic sprinklers. Now, that success notwithstanding, we've still got about 3,000 fire fatalities in the U.S. every year. So I got to wondering, since we've made such amazing progress, what would it take to get that death toll down to zero?
Yeah, I don't think you can get there, right? You can do zero defects in manufacturing and all that stuff, but you throw a human being in there and forget it. You can't get there.
Here's a couple interesting things to think about, though. The median number of people killed in a fire today is one, all right? Hmm. And the other thing is that about 85% of all fatal fires happen not in a factory or a school, but in a home. So that is where fire scientists are now trying to make progress. Here's Dan Madrikowski from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. He's excited about a new law you've got out there in California that requires all new homes to have automatic sprinkler systems.
If all homes were sprinklered, we would anticipate that the death rate due to fires would go down by at least 83%, and the average loss per home would come down by 74%.
So here's another idea, Kai. What if you could stop fires before they start? Can you guess what the leading cause of fatal fires in the home might be, Kai?
It has to be electrical, right? It's behind walls. You can't see it happening, and then boom, you're on fire.
Wonderful guess. Very, very wrong, but wonderful.
Not sadly wrong.
Very sensible guess, but smoking. Smoking is number one, right?
So,
you know, you fall asleep in bed with a cigarette. Now, you'd think, like you said, it's human error. You'd think there's not much you can do about something like that, right?
But you're about to tell me if I said right, I'd be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. That's the lesson we've learned here. When you say right,
that's
you're wrong.
That's right.
Unless you could make a cigarette that doesn't start fires, and that is what the folks at NIST, where our man Madrikowski works, have helped make happen.
In the past, cigarettes, if you start to smoke it and you leave it in the ashtray and you forget about it, it's going to basically burn itself up completely. Now with the less fire-prone cigarette, when you light it, it should self-extinguish.
Right. So these self-extinguishing cigarettes will soon be the only cigarettes legally available in all 50 states. And NIST is thinking that'll prevent another several hundred fire deaths a year. American ingenuity, you know, but it's also underappreciated ingenuity. Who do you think got his own postage stamp? The guy who invented the automatic sprinkler or the guy who invented FM radio?
Yeah, don't knock that guy with FM radio, man. It's one person in this conversation's livelihood depends on it. I'll tell you that. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomicsradio.com is the website. He's back in a couple of weeks. Dubner, we'll see you later.
See you soon, Kai. Thank you.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, if you can do this,
Aflac!
There is a job opening waiting for you. Remember we told you last week Aflac, the insurance company, has fired comedian Gilbert Gottfried, the voice of that duck, for making insensitive jokes about Japan. Well, the search is on for a replacement. Online open auditions, deadlines April the 1st. And seeing as how times are tough in journalism right now, we did a little pre-audition right around here.
Aflac.
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 Aflac. Aflac. Aflac.
Aflac.
I actually thought that they would be a lot worse than that, but who knows? Send us your tape. We'll make sure it gets to the right place. Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow nicked off 17 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ peeled away 8 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 splashed away 4 points, about a third of 1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you ought to tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news and updates on Libya and Japan and the whole smash. Coming up next time, back here, better living through green chemistry.
Rather than looking at how we design molecules that can treat or hopefully cure cancer, I want to try and come up with a way that all of the chemicals that we're surrounded by can cause cancer.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.